for individuals interested in the medical field. Welcome to the Doc Talk Podcast, where doctors from around the world discuss groundbreaking work in the medical industry. Because in an ever-changing world, healthcare is constant.
Well, I hope everyone tuning in to listen to the podcast is healthy, happy, and safe. It gives me great pleasure to announce the guest speaker for this event, which will have us feeling anything but numb. Dr. Philip Carew is an assistant professor of anesthesiology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He is an attending anesthesiologist in the Johns Hopkins Children's Center and provides anesthesia for pediatric patients undergoing a wide range of surgical procedures. He's also a member of the Pediatric Regional Anesthesia Team. He received his medical degree from the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. He is board certified in anesthesiology and pediatric anesthesiology. Dr. Carullo's research interests include technology and curriculum development, as well as understanding healthcare disparities in patients with development disabilities. He is also interested in fellow education and serves as the associate program director for the Pediatric Anesthesiology Fellowship at Johns Hopkins. We are super excited to have you on board, Doctor. Don't be afraid to knock yourself out answering these questions. Not literally, of course.
Well, thank you, Tanishka, for having me. I think this is a great idea, and I'm super excited to share what I think are the best parts about the field of anesthesiology.
That's great. Thank you so much for your time. So let's dive in. Well, I think a really important question that it's not spoken about as much is like the way people react to anesthesia, and I'm sure everyone reacts to it differently. So what would you say are like the major side effects and that you've seen, and how would you probably counteract a negative reaction to anesthesia?
Sure. So I'm going to just start a little bit more like a 10,000 foot view of anesthesia. As a pre-med student, anesthesia wasn't even something that was on my radar. I think if you're pre-med and you don't have family that's in medicine, you romanticize a doctor as somebody who just knows a little bit about everything in the human body. And generally speaking, know a little bit about a lot of disease states. So I imagine that you think of either a surgeon or an internal medicine doctor. And it wasn't until I was in my third year of medical school that I realized what anesthesia was and became quickly excited about the idea of becoming an anesthesiologist. And so briefly, an anesthesiologist is tasked with keeping a patient both in a medically induced coma, that's what we call anesthesia, and also expertly managing the human physiology and tailoring it to the needs of the surgeon. And so when you think about it, you know, having surgery, everyone just thinks, oh, I'm going to be knocked out, I'm going to go to sleep. And that's true, but it's not a light switch. And it's actually a very dynamic process that requires years and years of training and intense understanding of human physiology and how to manipulate it with the strongest drugs in the hospital. And also a really good understanding of all of the anesthetic drugs that we have available to us in medicine. You become an expert in inducing comas in patients of all ages and all disease states, and then also learning how to manipulate their physiology to meet the needs of the surgery. And I keep saying that, but it's super important. Let me give you one example. Let's say you have a patient that's having a liver transplant. Okay, the liver is a pretty important organ. And at some point during the surgery, the transplant surgeons are going to completely remove the liver out of the body. And that changes all of human physiology, I think, more than any other disease state or any other surgical procedure. And as an anesthesiologist, keeping the patient asleep is probably the easiest part of the procedure. The hardest part is keeping up with the massive blood loss that occurs, the extreme changes in acid-base status, glucose, lactate, managing the pressors that you're on to keep the patient's blood pressure in a reasonable range. And so there are a lot of things that happen, and it's really amazing some of the things that you do in anesthesia that you have no idea an anesthesiologist does until you're actually on your rotations as a third year medical student, seeing it for the first time. So I just wanted to give a 10,000 foot overview. It's not all just inducing comas. A lot of it is also managing physiology. And so that's what we do. We're experts in that. We learn about patients and their disease states, their age, and we understand what surgery they're having done. And we figure out how to keep the patient both asleep and safe until the surgery is done and they're out of the recovery room. So with that, I'll answer your question. The most common risks to anesthesia. You know, if you're a patient in this case, I mostly do pediatric anesthesia, but if you're the parent of a patient and you ask me what are the risks to anesthesia, I'll tell you that the most common risks are sore throat from a breathing tube, nausea from the anesthesia, and pain, which is not necessarily a side effect of anesthesia, but a side effect of the surgery that they're having. But in reality, anything can happen under anesthesia, including death. And that could be a result of the surgery or from an allergic reaction to the anesthesia itself. I also tell families are more likely to get into a car accident on their way to the hospital than to actually have a severe reaction under anesthesia. And so it's relatively safe when you have the experience and the training of an anesthesiologist. A lot of times the risks depend on, there are risks to the drugs. So most common risks are allergic reactions. And the drugs that we mostly have allergic reactions to are drugs that paralyze patients for surgery to keep them still, prevent them from moving. And then also antibiotics. So those are the most common drugs that patients are allergic to. There are also risks from the procedures that we do to patients. Anesthesiologists are kind of like the acute care doctors of the operating room, meaning that they not only have a huge knowledge base of how to induce comas and manage physiology, but we're also proceduralists. We place IVs, arterial lines, central lines. We do transesophageal echo. We place breathing tubes. And so there are risks with all of these procedures. With a breathing tube, there's a risk of chipping a tooth, chapping the lip, causing damage to the tongue, the throat. Injury to the lungs and the vocal cords when we place the breathing tube. So it really just depends. Overall, it is pretty safe. And so when I counsel patients, you have to tell them just enough so that they're informed, but not so much that they walk away from a surgery that they really need.
Of course, yeah. Thank you for that. That's so thorough.
So just a couple of things. So when you do an anesthesia residency, it's 4 years. So after you finish medical school, you do a 4-year residency in anesthesia. Mm-hmm. And after anesthesia, there are a handful of fellowships you can do. One of them is critical care medicine. And I bring that up because a lot of people understand what ICU doctors do, but they don't realize that you can be an ICU doctor from anesthesia after just one extra year of training. And I just bring that up because there are a lot of similarities between ICU and the operating room. The main difference is that the patients in the ICU are not having surgery, but they're still critically ill. They're connected to ventilators, they're in medically induced coma, and their physiology is being managed by the strongest blood pressure drugs that we have in the hospital. That's what anesthesiologists do every day, but we also tailor the physiology to the needs of the surgery. So there are a lot of similarities, and you'll find, depending on where you work, that a lot of anesthesiologists work both in the operating room and in the ICU.
That's great. You guys are really versatile, you know, with how you have to handle a situation. That's great. I think you touched upon this in your previous answer, but could you just go over procedures like epidural, arterial lines, central lines, and transesophageal echoes and stuff like that that you guys do?
Sure. So there are really only two, in my mind, two broad categories of physicians that actually deliver patient care, meaning they physically touch, interact, and deliver care to patients. One of them are surgeons, and that makes sense. They're physically operating on a patient. The other group of physicians that physically deliver care are anesthesiologists. So we place all of the procedures I'll talk to you about, we draw up all of our own medications, we personally administer them. And so that's one of the unique aspects of our field. The procedures that I'll talk to you about are the most common ones. One is an IV catheter. That's placed by a lot of providers in the hospital, nurses, nursing aides, physicians, anesthesiologists, so on. And intravenous catheter is basically a small plastic tube that sits in a vein that you can then connect to tubing and administer medications through. And so when you have an IV catheter in place, you can basically administer any type of medication through it. Another common line is an arterial line. This is, again, a small plastic tubing, but instead of going into a vein, goes into an artery. And the reason why you would do this is that with this plastic tube in the artery, you can measure blood pressure every single second. So instead of waiting for a blood pressure cuff to go up and squeeze the arm and then deflate and give you a number, you have real time, moment by moment, beat by beat measurement of the blood pressure. And that's really important when you're taking care of patients that have surgeries where blood pressure is really important, like heart surgery or brain surgery or a transplant. An arterial line also lets you, because it's a high pressure system, draw blood back through the catheter and use it to monitor blood levels, pH, glucose levels, and things like that. So you typically place it for patients that need surgery if you are worried about big changes in blood pressure or you want to be able to monitor blood levels throughout the procedure. Another common procedure that we do is intubation, which is basically placing a breathing tube so that you can connect a patient to the ventilator. And we perform this by placing a metal blade in the patient's mouth and sliding it down the tongue in the back of the throat, and then moving the airway structures out of the way so that we can see the vocal cords. And then we place a plastic tube called a breathing tube in through the vocal cords and into the trachea of the lungs so that we can then connect them to the ventilator and control their breathing. An epidural is most commonly kind of heard about or discussed for laboring women who are pregnant and about to give birth. And a epidural is basically a procedure we do where we have a patient hunch over and we clean off their back and place a needle in between two of the vertebrae in their back, and we place the needle until we reach what we call the epidural space. That's a space where the nerves come out of the spinal cord, and then you can administer numbing medicine around those nerves, and that numbing medicine will numb the belly or numb the pelvic area so that the pain from childbirth is dampened. Transesophageal echo is a procedure you can do when a patient is asleep. And it's basically placing what we call an ultrasound probe, it's basically a long kind of tube into the patient's food pipe or the esophagus. And then the esophagus sits right behind the heart. And so what you end up getting is an ultrasound that sits right behind the heart, and then you can monitor the heart in real time and look at all of its structures, and that helps you make decisions about management of the patient. It also helps cardiac anesthesiologists when patients are having heart surgery.
Yeah, that's great. So, I mean, going off of that, how would you probably resuscitate a hemodynamically unstable patient? What about a patient with sepsis or cardiovascular, fall? Like, how would you resuscitate a patient? Because I'm sure anesthesiologists are like master resuscitators in the field of medicine.
Yeah, so that's a good question. It's a great question. And part of the success is being prepared to resuscitate. So having all of your emergency drugs, equipment, medications, IV fluids, blood products, having all those things available and anticipating it ahead of time. Probably the biggest factor of success with keeping a patient who's critically unstable alive is having everything you need to manage it right there in the moment and not waiting. And so that's probably, I think, the most important thing. The other, answer to your question is, what is the cause of the patient being unstable? Is it that, the surgeon accidentally severed a big vessel and now they're bleeding? Because you can give all the blood products and blood pressure medicines in the world, it's not going to keep the patient alive. The only thing that's going to keep them alive is the surgeon clamping the vessel and repairing it? Or is that the patient is just critically ill and has a whole bunch of dead bowel in their abdomen and it needs to be resected? In that case, you have to stabilize them the way you would a patient who's septic and allow the surgeon to perform the procedure to get rid of all the bad stuff in the body. So it depends on the situation, but broadly speaking, the tools that you have available to you are antibiotics in the case of a patient who's infected. Those are really important in a patient with sepsis. And then blood pressure medications to ensure that you have blood pressures that are adequate to supply vital organs like the brain and the liver and the kidneys. And then fluids, IV fluids like normal saline or lactated Ringer, albumin and blood products. And those are kind of the big things. And then also you need to have laboratory data frequently when you're managing a critically ill patient so that you can understand the effects of the procedures and the medications that you're giving. Are you doing a good job with your resuscitation or are you behind? And if you're behind, what should you be giving next? And so you need laboratory data available to help you make those decisions.
Of course. So what kind of agents would you say are used for like tachycardia and bradycardia in anesthesia?
Sure. So the obvious thing is that we have medications, vasoactive medications that can make if the heart rate is low, it can bring the heart rate up. If the heart rate is high, we can bring the heart rate down. But a lot of times we have to also know what is the cause of the high heart rate or the low heart rate, because sometimes you may not need a blood pressure medicine at all to treat it. For example, if you have a patient who's in a medically induced coma and the surgery is about to begin and the surgeon takes a scalpel and makes a big incision down the patient's belly, the heart rate's going to go up. That's pain. I would never give a beta blocker or a heart rate lowering drug to treat that. I would give a pain medicine to treat that. Alternatively, if you have a small baby whose blood pressure or heart rate is low, and it's occurring in the context of that baby struggling to get oxygen, part of the treatment may be to give a medicine to increase the heart rate, but the actual treatment is to help that patient breathe, because that low heart rate is a response to the low oxygen level. So to answer your question, we have vasoactive drugs that can increase heart rate or decrease heart rate, but a lot of times you have to ask yourself, why is the heart rate high? Why is the heart rate low? And then you can pick the best medication or intervention to normalize it.
Yeah, that's really insightful. When I was back home in India, I'm from Mumbai, India, and I had to shadow a neurosurgeon, and I was working in his cath lab. And what happened was, I think the anesthesiologist had not administered atropine during an angioplasty. Can you tell me why exactly it's important for that to be administered during an angioplasty when they're expanding the balloon?
Mm-hmm. So again, this goes back actually to college level physiology. You may have remembered that you have these baroreceptors on certain parts of your body, and most notably the carotid arteries. Mm-hmm. So what you're talking about is a stent that's placed in the carotid artery to increase blood flow through that area, because the carotid arteries is an area where you can get a buildup of plaque. And a buildup of plaque stops blood flow from going to the heart, to the brain, and perfusing the brain. And so you can go in and place a stent to open up that area and push the plaque out of the way. What ends up happening is when you go to put anything in the carotid arteries, like a balloon, and you're trying to expand the stent in that vessel, the carotid baroreceptors interpret that increase in pressure as the body having high blood pressure. And that stimulates a reflex bradycardia. So it causes the heart rate to drop, because one of the ways the body can decrease blood pressure if it's too high is to drop the heart rate. And so the carotid arteries think that the blood pressure is really high because it feels a balloon or a stent expanding inside of it. And so in order to try to maintain a normal homeostasis, it drops the heart rate to counteract that high blood pressure. And so as an anesthesiologist or an anesthesia provider, you have to anticipate that that may happen when a surgeon or a proceduralist is trying to expand something in the carotid artery, and you can counteract that low heart rate by giving a medication like atropine, which will bring it up.
That's so interesting. I would never have guessed that, you know, just to anticipate things that, you know, aren't necessarily by the book, and just to be one step ahead of the game, you know, that's really interesting. I just wanted to know, you know, I've read your research, and it seems that you're very interested in the current developments in your field, and recent developments in pharmacology and pharmacokinetics has intrigued you the most.
Every specialty in medicine is evolving, and they say, I can't remember the exact stat, but something along the lines of most of the stuff you learn in medical school, by the time you're done with your residency, is going to, much of it will be outdated. And many of the drugs that you learn in your pharmacology class will be replaced and outdated, and you'll have to learn new ones. And that's certainly been true for most specialties. In anesthesia, however, a lot of the drugs that we use to keep people asleep have pretty much stayed the same. They're tried and tested. And although there are some new, you know, variations of drugs that are coming out, they're all basically the same classes of drugs. And so there's not much new there. What is changing, though, and what has recently changed, is that we have a new reversal agent for a class of drugs called neuromuscular blocking drugs. So a lot of patients that have surgery, we actually, when they're asleep, we'll paralyze them. We'll give them drugs that actually make them paralyzed. And for a long time, you had to be very careful about how much, you know, paralyzing drug you would give, because it would takes time to fade away. And if you give too much, then the patient, you know, you have to keep them asleep until that drug gets metabolized, and then you can wake them up. But now we have a drug that was around in Europe for a long time, but just came to the US, called Sugammadex. And this drug is actually a reversal agent. So really, no matter how paralyzed the patient is, you can give this drug, and within minutes, it completely counteracts the effect of the paralytic drug, and you can wake the patient up. That's pretty cool and exciting. But what I think, you know, beyond like new drugs in anesthesia, I think new technology is becoming something that is increasingly exciting. We have all sorts of new tools and gadgets that we're using that make it really fun. And I would say the most exciting is the use of ultrasound. Ultrasound's been around forever. But in some specialties like emergency medicine, the ICU, and in anesthesia, ultrasound is becoming a game changer. I have my own personal ultrasound that I just keep in a little fanny pack that I wear because you never know when you'll need it. We'll use ultrasound to place IVs. We'll use ultrasound to confirm a breathing tube placement. We'll use ultrasound to look at the heart while we give medicines to fall asleep. We can use ultrasound for literally everything. And it's really becoming something that is changing how we practice and how we make decisions. And it's certainly becoming something that medical students and residents are learning more and more about.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. So in terms of the drugs that you mentioned, how do stereoisomers of an anesthetic drugs affect their potency?
Really, the only drug I can think of that we use the stereoisomer of is ketamine. And so we don't really think about that too much on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. When I think of drugs and potency, I think in anesthesia, I think of opioids. You know, we have, they're constantly, when I told you there are not that many developments of new drugs, the one class where that's an exception are opioids. You know, I think originally you had really just morphine, and then that evolved to fentanyl and hydromorphone and remifentanyl, sufentanyl, alfentanyl. These are all increasingly becoming more and more potent, meaning you only need really small doses to have a dramatic and profound effect. It also means that even the smallest doses can cause a patient to stop breathing. And so these drugs have really interesting uses beyond just for pain in the operating room. For example, if you give a patient who's having surgery an infusion of a really potent medication called remifentanil, which is a potent form of fentanyl, it basically has the same effect as a paralyzing drug. These patients won't move. You can do whatever you want to and they won't move. And then when you turn it off, after about 10 or 15 minutes, it completely goes away and they wake up. So it's a very, very interesting, some of the properties you get with these ultra potent opioids. But in terms of on a daily basis, thinking of, you know, stereoisomers and potency, it's not something we really think about much in anesthesia.
Yeah, well, I understand that. Well, the opioid crisis has been a topic of discussion in the US. And so how would you say the anesthesia field is combating this, and what alternatives are being used for analgesia instead of opioids and synthetic opioids like fentanyl, which are like very easy to, are inexpensive and are just very easy to develop. You know, it's definitely something that's, you know, a little scary in the pharmacology field because of how easy it is to develop and ship around as opposed to other opioids. Are there any alternative drugs that can be used instead of opioids?
So I have a personal, you know, story when it comes to opioids. So my brother died of an overdose when I was in college. I was actually probably around where you were in college, and pre-med, super eager and excited. And my brother overdosed. And this was at the time, I think, when the opioid epidemic was really really just starting. No one, it was really taboo to say you had a loved one that died of an overdose. And now you'll find most people that know somebody who did. And so I used to, you know, think that opioids were bad. And as an anesthesiologist, I don't think that way anymore. I think that you have to be careful with opioids. You have to counsel people appropriately. And at least in this, the perioperative environment, the biggest risk factor for somebody developing, you know, a long-term use of opioids is really a prescription that they go home with. How many pills are they getting when they go home with? That's really the biggest determinant of whether they're going to use opioids long-term. It's not, you know, how much they get in the operating room. But, you know, I think you'll always need opioids to treat acute pain, pain that is happening in an acute setting, like from a surgery or from a trauma. You're always going to need it. But we do try to be mindful of the fact that we're in, you know, the midst of a epidemic, and we are always thinking of fun and unique and meaningful ways to treat pain that avoid opioids. One of probably the most promising fields to do this is regional anesthesia. So as an anesthesiologist, one of the skill sets you learn is how to take an ultrasound machine and find big nerve bundles in the body. And the arms, the legs, the belly, and the abdomen, the scalp, the ankle, pretty much every part of the body, right, has a nerve that supplies sensation to it. And so just like the dentist can administer numbing medicine to numb your gum when they're fixing a cavity, we can administer numbing medicine around nerves. And if we do that, then whatever those nerves are supplying become completely numb. So if you're having arm surgery, we can take an ultrasound, find the nerves of the arm, inject numbing medicine, and now that entire arm is relaxed and pain-free. And we can do a bunch of things. We can do a one-time shot, and usually one-time numbing shots can last 8 to 16 hours, depending on what you numb it with. There are no opioids in that. And then you can also put, just like you have an IV, and you can have an IV catheter where you can infuse medicines, we can do numbing shots and leave little catheters and keep infusing numbing medicine for days or weeks, depending on the procedure. And so it's possible that all of your pain relief for certain types of surgeries can be done with no opioid and only using numbing medicines. That's called regional anesthesia. It's something that I do on a daily basis, and many anesthesiologists do for their patients. That's probably the biggest thing, in addition to using other medications like Tylenol, NSAIDs like Motrin or ibuprofen. There are a group of other medications called gabapentinoids. These are all medicines that try to tackle pain from a non-opioid receptor standpoint.
That's great. I'm so sorry for your loss. And it's very interesting to see that you've come full circle from that experience and what you're doing right now, saving lives. That's amazing. Good for you. I just wanted to know, like, since you're basically, your specialty is pediatrics, what would you say is the drug of choice for myocardial contractility in pediatrics and why?
So this is an interesting question, and I'll tell you probably the right answer is that it depends on where you're working. Culturally speaking, there tends to be a practice for pediatrics in terms of if you need a blood pressure or a medicine to help the heart beat stronger. Some people will use medication like dopamine, and they do that, I think, mostly out of a cultural practice. I say, you know, the tried and tested medication that's going to make your heart beat faster is epinephrine. It's the naturally produced drug in your body, and we can infuse it through a bag into the veins, and it helps your heart. I think it really depends where you work, you know, in terms of what the right answer is. But for me, if I have a patient in the operating room and I need the heart to beat stronger, I'm going to reach for something that acts directly that the heart is used to, and I'm going to reach for epinephrine.
Yeah, that's very valid. So I know anesthesia involves pre-anesthesia, induction, maintenance, and post-anesthesia. So what are the aspects of each component, and like, what are some of the drugs associated with pre-anesthesia, especially in pediatric anesthesiology?
So it's a good question, and maybe we should have started with this one in terms of framing what it is that anesthesiologists do. But basically, an anesthesiologist lives in the operating room or in the pre-op area, in the operating room, and in the recovery room. That's pretty much the main place you'll find us. Surgeons kind of come and go. They come from clinic or seeing patients on the floor to the operating room to work, and then they go back out to the clinic or the floor to take care of patients there. We're really the only physicians that live in this, what we call the perioperative environment, the pre-op, the intra-op, and post-op. And so you'll always find us there. And that's what we do. We focus all of our energy and the knowledge that we have to provide care, both when a patient first comes to the pre-op area and we meet them, we do a physical or a history and a physical, we understand their medical problems, any medications they're on, and we, you know, confirm what surgery they're having, and we make sure that if there's anything that they need before surgery to make them optimize, that we do that. And then we bring them back to the operating room and we take care of them for the surgery. And after the surgery, we wake them up and bring them to the recovery room where we make sure that they recover well, that if they're having any nausea or pain, that we treat it so that they can go home safely and comfortably. And so that's pretty much what we do. That's the pre-op evaluation, the intra-op management, and the post-op recovery. In terms of medications that we typically give, it depends on the age group of the patient and some individual properties about them. So in the pediatric operating room, for example, we meet the parents and the patient, and we meet them in pre-op, and they're often very nervous and scared. The kids usually don't really understand what's going on. Or they can understand at a developmentally appropriate level. Maybe a teenager understands what's going on, but, you know, a toddler or a small child may just know that they're at some place other than home and that they're going to have something fixed on their body. The parents, on the other hand, they understand completely what's happening and they're really scared. They have their child and they're trusting a stranger to, you know, keep them asleep and keep them safe. And so a lot of times we talk about giving a medication to help the patient feel relaxed so that when they separate from their parents and go back with strangers into the operating room, that they're not so scared or sad. And so we often give a medication called midazolam, which is benzodiazepine. And that medicine has a similar effect on the brain and works on the brain in a similar way as alcohol. And so depending on the dose that we give, the patients may just feel calm, relaxed, silly, goofy, or sleepy. And what we find is that if we give this to patients before about 15 or 20 minutes before it's time to go back into the operating room, the patients feel calm. When we separate from the parents, they're not as scared. The family or the parents feel a lot better too, because their kid's not crying when they're leaving them. And it just helps ease the whole process of bringing them back and taking care of them.
Yeah. When I was little, I actually fractured and dislocated my metacarpal, and I needed to get a rod, a surgery to input a rod and remove it later on. And I had inhalation agents as opposed to an IV before the surgery. Mm-hmm. So what affects the alveolar concentration of inhalation agents, and what factors affect the uptake and distribution of these agents?
That's an awesome question, and definitely like a question for a resident and a fellow in terms of like the scientific like value and merit of that question. But what I'll tell you is probably more interesting to medical students is talking about the differences between, you know, how one can go to sleep. So you're right in that most teenagers and adults, if they're having a surgery, they get an IV placed in the pre-op area. And then when we go back into the operating room, we fall asleep with medication through the IV. And that's really fast, because when you give medicine through the IV, it goes directly to the heart, and then the heart pumps it directly to the brain. And within seconds, the drug has an effect on the brain, and boom, you're in a medically induced coma. It can happen really quickly. But in kids, we're really nice people, and we don't want to put them through the pain and suffering of holding them down and placing an IV, so we can fall asleep with sleepy air through a mask. And so the typical, you know, process for that is kind of how I described. We'll see the patient, give them some relaxing medicine. They'll feel calm and sleepy and goofy. We bring them back into the operating room, and then we take a mask and we infuse both oxygen and the medication called sevoflurane, which is an anesthetic drug, but it's a gas. And so we hold the mask over the patient's face, and they breathe that mixture. And after about 20 or 30 seconds of breathing it, they start to fall into a deep, deep sleep. That is called an inhalational induction, which is different than the induction that we do with an IV. Inhalational inductions, or falling asleep with the mask, is its own skill set that you learn as a pediatric anesthesiologist, and it has a lot of risks. But it allows you to put the patient asleep, and then you can put the IV in when they're asleep, and it's just a better experience for patients. The main thing when you think about falling asleep with an inhalational gas is that them falling asleep takes longer, because you got to hold a mask over their face. They have to breathe in the sleepy gas. The sleepy gas has to diffuse through the linings of the lungs into the blood. Those gas bubbles have to go to the heart and then into the brain. And it takes a lot longer, and it requires you to be confident that you can keep that patient's airway breathing gas in and out until they fall asleep. Because some patients these days are pretty overweight. They have something called sleep apnea. You try to put them to sleep, they start snoring, and now you're not exchanging air so quickly. And so it can make the whole process a lot longer. But the things that typically affect the speed of going to sleep with an inhalational anesthetic will be, one, your ability to keep air moving in and out. So making sure that the tissue in the mouth doesn't obstruct and collapse, and now you can't breathe for the patient. Two, any lung disease that the patient has. Three, any heart disease that they have. Those are really the big things, because blockages in all those areas will make the process a lot longer and riskier. So if you can't exchange air from obstruction, that's bad. If the patient has lung disease, or let's say a patient who has COPD doesn't have as much alveolar or space to diffuse, that's going to speed the process up. If the patient is sick and the heart's beating really, really, really fast, that actually means that it's harder for the lungs to deliver gas to the blood in a meaningful concentration. And so that slows things down too. It's a very loaded question, but those are the general principles.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for your response. I think you touched upon this in the sense that you spoke about the types of you know, problems that they might have, and you should be aware of, like lung problems and heart problems, etc. How would you deal with a situation where your patient is on anticoagulant and antiplatelet drugs like warfarin and other drugs before surgery?
So the most of the time, the indications for being on a blood thinning medication would be if you've had a history of a blood clot, or if you have some kind of metal in your body, like a stent in your heart, that requires your blood to be thin or your platelets to be less reactive. And so you may be on a blood thinner or an antiplatelet drug. And that is pretty bad for surgery, right? Because with surgery, you're going to cut things, and things that get cut bleed, and you're going to bleed more if your blood is thin. And that increases your risk of needing blood pressure medications or blood products or things like that. And so that is typically more of a problem for adults, because adults typically end up getting older and developing heart disease that requires them to have these kind of procedures and to be on blood thinners. But it can happen to children too. There are some children that are on blood thinners for blood clots. And the most important thing is that whenever you have a patient on a blood thinner, you need to plan. You need to plan for surgery. And so a lot of times these patients will be either transitioned off of their blood thinner or bridged to something like heparin, which can be reliably shut off and the blood thinning returned to normal in time for surgery. So it's really all about planning. And so if you have time to plan, it's not a big deal. There's a set way to manage it so that these patients' blood goes from being thin to normal for surgery. And then after surgery, they're transitioned back from their normal blood to thin blood when it's safe. If it's an emergency and you don't have time to transition them off this, like let's say a patient's has a blood thinner, is in a car accident now, and they're bleeding and it's an emergency, that's a real problem. And so there are ways to manage it. We have some rescue drugs we can use that are extremely expensive to try to get the blood to just clot. But a lot of times it requires them to get lots and lots of blood products, resuscitation drugs, and these super expensive special medications. But that's rare that happens.
Yeah, I can imagine, especially in pediatrics, it is probably rare, because heart problems and cardiovascular problems are mostly associated with plaque buildup in older age, I'm assuming. So what is like the main cause of anesthetic morbidity and mortality, according to you?
That's a good question. Mortality is bad. Mm-hmm. It's not super common from anesthesia by itself. And I would say most mortality is going to be from a devastating complication while you're taking care of the patient, either a severe allergic reaction to an anesthesia drug or anesthesia itself. There's something called malignant hyperthermia, which is an allergic reaction to anesthesia gases. You can always have anaphylaxis to any drug that we give. And then there are other things that can happen that are scary, like something called aspiration. So when you're putting a patient to sleep and placing a breathing tube, they can vomit, and all of this, the vomit from the stomachs can go into the lungs and cause a severe pneumonia that can be life-threatening or life-ending. Accidentally placing the breathing tube in the esophagus and not in the lungs and not realizing it in time. Those are some common things that can cause death. The most common things that lead to just unhappy patients would be chipping a tooth or chapping the lip from a breathing tube placement, missing an IV attempt and having a bruise where you tried, having a reaction to a drug that's non-life-threatening, like a rash or some swelling. Having an injury caused from tape. We often tape the eyes or tape the breathing tube to the face. And when you take tape off, it can rip some layers of the skin off. So you can have some cuts or abrasions or just marks or skin sensitivity from that. Mm-hmm. In general, anesthesia is safe. It's a young field. It started in 1846 in Boston, and has evolved dramatically since that time. And now we have standards for how to monitor patients and keep them safe. And we have residency programs that are very robust. And so severe complications are pretty low.
Yeah, I'm sure it only gets better with time, you know. My final question to you is, do you have like a message you'd like to tell future physicians who want to pursue anesthesiology?
So first of all, for anybody who's pre-med right now, I just want to acknowledge that it's really hard. It's really competitive. I think from going to college, medical school, residency, fellowship, and now working at Johns Hopkins, the hardest part of it all was college. I literally would calculate for every test, what score could I get so that I could still get an A at the end of the semester so that my GPA would be a 3 whatever, and that I could then be competitive to apply to med school. If that doesn't sound familiar to you, then I don't know. But I'm pretty sure you know what I'm saying.
Of course.
And it's really hard. And then when you finally get into medical school, you made it. All you have to do is just keep that skill set, those good habits you built, like studying hard and finding the right group of friends. You know, you want nerdy friends during the week and less nerdy friends on the weekend. And you want to keep that going in medical school, but you put your head down and at the end of it, you're going to be a doctor. And then in residency, it just gets fun. You're like, finally, I'm taking care of patients. And yeah, it has a learning curve and gets tough, but no matter what specialty you pick, it just gets better and better. And then when you're finally done with your training and you're now the attending, you're making the money you thought you'd be making. Taking care of patients is a lot easier now because you did a residency, so you don't feel so scared all the time. And then I think after this, you know, your whole career passes by and you're like ready to retire. You're in the hardest part of it right now. Keep your head down, work hard. This is the time to really just like focus and do what you have to do to get into med school. For people that want to do anesthesia, I think you need to, if it sounds interesting to you, you have to create your own opportunities. Join an interest group, try to do some shadowing during your first and second years. When you're a third year, if your school doesn't offer anesthesia, then try to, you know, make an elective opportunity to get some time and to meet us. And anesthesia is a pretty competitive specialty. It is well compensated, but that's because it's super risky. I mean, like every day, even though I don't feel the stress at work because now I'm comfortable doing it, I have the potential to literally kill every patient I take care of in seconds, which is scary, but really not so scary because I have all this training and I feel prepared to do my job. But anesthesia as a whole is a phenomenal field. You're literally like one of the most valuable physicians in terms of skill sets, no matter what you do or where you go. If you're on a plane or there's an accident on the side of the road or you're walking in the hallway and someone collapses. I mean, you literally have the skill set to check the pulse, start an IV, give a medication, place a breathing tube, call for help. I mean, like you have the skill set to do all this stuff. You're super prepared to help manage acute care medicine. And the field is just growing and it's super exciting. The use of ultrasound is really giving us skill sets that allow us to be versatile and to make better decisions. I think the field is promising. And I encourage anybody who's potentially interested and just creating an opportunity to shadow when they're first and second years and to do an elective when they're third years.
That's great, doctor. You actually made me look forward to the whole long, tedious process that is going and becoming a doctor. Most doctors talk about how they're burnt out and, you know, how long and strenuous and hardworking it is. But I guess, you know, if you really love the field, it's just something you look forward to every day. And your message really like makes me look forward to that and to work with people hands on. Thank you so much for your time. I love speaking to you today. It was very, very insightful. Thank you so much. And I hope you have a great rest of your day and week.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I mean this when I say, feel free to include my email address. If anybody has questions, I'm happy to
definitely do that.
To respond. Yeah. I've done a fair amount of mentoring for pre-meds and med students and residents. I can't promise that I can do that if people reach out to me. But if you have a genuine interest in anesthesia and want to know more, feel free to reach out to me. And I'm happy to talk to you or even connect you to people that are at the next step in the process that can mentor you at that level as well. And my final comment for anybody who's pre-med is that, you know, it is true. There are a lot of obstacles being a doctor. And it's partially because medicine is also a business, even though that's not how you romanticize it in your head. But I'll tell you what, you know, the most important thing is that when you're in med school and you're doing your rotations, is that you give up any preconceived idea about what you thought you wanted to do. Some people become obsessed with the concept of, I want to be a heart surgeon or a brain surgeon. Totally fine. But if you find that when you're on your heart surgery or your brain surgery rotation that you feel some tension or you really don't love it, don't do it. You know, do the rotation that you feel excited and happy about every day when you're on it. It's about sustainability. And the longer you go through the process, the harder it is to turn back. So my final message is that work hard in undergrad. When you're in med school, be honest with yourself about the things that you like and you don't like, and then absolutely do the thing that you like, even if it's completely different than what you thought it was going to be, because then you're going to be happy and you're going to work hard no matter what. But if you love what you do, it is a great, great career.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, doctor. Thank you so much for your time. I'm very, very grateful to you for like meeting with me and just taking time out to have this little talk with me and enlighten, you know, pre-med students like myself. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I wish you good luck. Let me know if you ever need anything.
I need it. Thank you so much, doctor. See you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.